106.8.
Hello there and welcome to another edition of Sunshine Reads with me, Elaine Stenson. This evening I'm joined by a man with the most incredible and inspiring story, a chartered surveyor who became the MD of Hamilton Osborne King. Not even the loss of his legs in a fire has stopped him rising to that top position, leading 250 staff. He's also the first ever double amputee in the world to get a helicopter pilot's license. Also has managed to become an author and motivational speaker to boot, and works with many leading companies including Tesco's, Bank of Ireland, VHI, Leinster Rugby and Specsavers. A very busy man. Paul McNeeve, you're very welcome to the studio this evening.
Thanks, Elaine. Great to be here.
Now, your story is truly fascinating, and I do want to talk about an incident that happened to you that many would describe as tragic, but you have made the most of it. You were in a fire that caused you to lose your legs.
Yeah. It was December 1982. That's a long time ago. And I was 20 and I was involved in a car crash and the car went on fire. And I suffered very bad burns on my hands and lots of but my legs got the worst of it. And I ended up in the Burns Hospital, which is now the HSE headquarters down beside Houston Station. And funny, that building crops up on the news all the time in interviews with Simon Harris or whoever outside the place. And I can see my room, which was the first room in the right-hand corner. So it reminds me of it. And to put that in a time context for people, I found myself surrounded by some of the last survivors of the Stardust nightclub disaster, who had been there 18 months at that stage, you know. So it was a tough place, I can tell you. A few months later, I went in there in December, and it was in February that I lost my legs. You know, there was a couple of months battle of trying to save them with endless skin grafting, and the toughest period I'm sure I'll ever face in my life. But I got through it.
Paul, you had been through the most life-changing experience that anyone could possibly think of going through, but you made it through. And you had lost the use of both of your legs, but tell me about how it came that you were able to go back to work.
Sure, well, it's all down to the rehabilitation hospital, the skill of the people out there, the people who make prosthetic legs. These days, like as the song goes, I am titanium, but not everyone can sing that and really mean it, but I am. Those days, it was real prototype timber kind of stuff, you know. The changes in technology has been amazing, so that's been a great help. But it's down to what everyone did for me out there: physiotherapists, occupational therapists, the nuns, the doctors, the people who make the legs. I mean, they do an amazing job. So I got back to work on two crutches. After a while I got rid of one crutch, after a while I got rid of another crutch, so you know, I was able to walk around, and I just kind of got better and better at that. And the firm had been very good, and computers had just arrived in Ireland, would you believe, sort of the mid-80s. And the idea was that I would work the computers. Now, before that, I had been out and about meeting people and on sites and showing properties. And I'm not very techie, and I got bored with the computers pretty quickly. And I just wanted to get back to doing what I had been doing. So put my little plans in place that I'd been told. How do you make things happen? You put a little plan in place. Here's three little things I need to do in the next week. And I put my hand up for every bit of work that you could possibly find to do. And I did it as enthusiastically and as fast as I could, and came running back looking for more work. And when you do that for a while, you stand out. And I got moved back to a department. And then I said, well, okay, I might want to be in that department. Then I got to be sort of ahead of a department. And I kind of shot up through the ranks. And then, I suppose, to some extent, bypassed anyone's expectations of where I was going to get. I was made a director at a young age, and then asked to be the managing director. And it was of a big, hugely successful business as it is now. And then we sold the business to Savills for 50 million euro. So my maths were working that week, okay. And I retired then from Savills in 2008, I think. And really, I had done 28 years at that stage, and I was felt like I had finished my term as managing director, and it was a question of, well, would I put my hat in the ring for that again, or did I want to do different things? And I felt I wanted to do something different. So I had a dream. One thing I wanted to do was write books, because I'm a big book lover and read a book a week. And also, I had sort of drifted into the world of speaking. When you were MD of Savills, which is a big, big company, you would be asked to speak by a bank or the IDA or someone at some conference or convention. And I kind of got used to that. And the more you do it, the more you get asked. And I could see that there is a good business in this, speaking for companies, you know, at the start of the year, getting everyone motivated, or management weekends away. You know, they get someone in to, if you like, stir things up a bit, get people to think differently, challenge the way we see things. And I really set out on that path, and that's really what pays the bills. That's my main work these days, and it's taken me around the world a couple of times speaking.
Do you think that because you were in rehabilitation for 18 months that you felt maybe you'd lost that time, you know, you hadn't been able to work? Do you think that time, was that in your head all the time, that you had to catch up maybe?
I'd say for a while it was, yeah. I probably maybe tried a bit harder just to catch up, because I did have to catch up. Because, you know, you are at a level of guys of your age, you study, you do exams, you're working, and, you know, you tend to, every year you go another level, and I suddenly missed out. And the guys I was with had gone 2 years ahead of me, and I'd been written off. So I had a lot of catching up to do, but I did. So, I loved the business and the people business, and I loved the property business, and it was all commercial property. And here in Dublin Docklands, we're on a site here. I sold this site, I'm sure I did. You could look out the window here, I sold almost every site around us on Sheriff Street and Mayor Street and Castle Forbes, and in those, you know, when the docks started changing from industrial yards into office blocks. So, you know, it was a really exciting time and thing to be involved in. And
if you weren't busy enough, you decided to become the first ever double amputee in the world to get a helicopter pilot's license. How did that happen?
I did, yeah. It's funny. I grew up dreaming of being a pilot as a little kid, and my grandfather was an air traffic controller, and as a kid I was bombarded with pictures of planes and toy planes and model planes and books about planes, and I just thought, imagine being a pilot. But when I did my average leaving cert and my below average maths when I was 17, I didn't even dream for a second I was smart enough to be a pilot. I couldn't be. You'd have to be really good at maths, I thought, to be a pilot. And I just didn't even try. So I went into a state agency. But I couldn't get it out of my system. And about 20 years later, and at that stage I'd lost my legs, my late uncle, Brian Connolly, ran the Dublin Gliding Club in Punchestown, and I went and did a bit of gliding with him. But I couldn't work the right pedal in a glider. Couldn't get my foot down on it properly. And someone said, try a small plane, and that was better. But I still couldn't work the right pedal. Someone said, try helicopters. You sit up much more upright. It's nearly like at a desk. And I did, and I found I could work the pedals. So I decided I'd be a helicopter pilot. So I did, put my little plan in place, all the little steps. And after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing with the Irish Aviation Authority, who were very good, but, you know, it was a bit of a thing for them to cope with, but they did. And I did my test and I passed, and I flew helicopters for fun for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, until about 5 years ago when I kind of drifted out of it. But it came out after a while that I was the first in the world.
How did that come out?
It came out because I got a phone call from a magazine in the UK who said, we see you've got a license in Robinson 44 helicopter. I said, yeah. And you're a double amputee. He said, we've asked around, and as far as we're concerned, you're the first in the world. Can we do an interview? I said, yeah. So that's how it came out. But the funny thing was, I mean, it was interesting to hear that I was the first person in the world to do it, but I think the more interesting thing is to look at the change in my mindset. Because when I was 17, as fit as a fiddle, no reason in the world why I couldn't have been a pilot. But I didn't think I was good enough. 20 years later, I've now lost my legs. It's 20 times harder, 30, 40, 50 times harder. In fact, it's never, ever been done. But now I start out and it's only a matter of time. So isn't that a powerful change of mindset?
Okay, Paul, we're going to pause now and take a quick break for your first song. And you've chosen today Bonnie Tyler's Total Eclipse of the Heart. Here it is, and we'll be back in just a few moments.
Turn around. Every now and then I get a little bit lonely and Sunshine 106.8.
Hello there, you're very welcome back to Sunshine Meets. It's me, Elaine Stenson. I'm joined in the studio this evening by businessman and motivational speaker, Paul McNeve. Is this a very strange question, but is there any way that you're glad it happened to you?
People, no is the answer, but you know, sometimes people, another way of asking that, I suppose, is would I have done half of these things, you know, if I hadn't? And I wouldn't. I quite simply is the answer. I wouldn't have done half the things I've done. I don't think I would have led a huge company.
Where do you see yourself if it hadn't happened?
I think I just would have just drifted along merrily and happily and been relatively average at everything, and that's fine. You know, and I have to give myself a kick in the ass quite often because I'm as lazy as the next person, you know.
I don't think you are, Paul,
well,
I have to
I'm
say.
I'll tell you, you want to see me watching Sky Sports on the weekend, you'd be amazed. I can string together hours of it. So, you know, it's just to have a little thing in you that's kind of burning in you, that, and it's a confidence that we have more potential than we realise. And it's such a shame to waste it. And I find myself, I say, 3 months have gone by, what have I done of any contribution to myself or the world or anything other than just drift? And I give myself a kick in the backside and go and do something useful.
But as mental health is such a big deal nowadays and it's such a huge issue for everyone out there, it would have been understandable for you to get depressed. And how do you overcome negative thinking?
Yeah, it's tough. I have bad days, you know.
It's a difficult time of the year as well for people. A lot of people do get depressed around Christmas time. It can be very lonely for people.
Absolutely.
So what's your biggest piece of advice for people to overcome?
Oh, well, I always say get out and about, talk to people, be with people, do things. You know, the worst thing is just sitting at home, watching telly, getting out of bed too late. You get into an awful rut. And, you know, there are patches. You know, when you say you need a bit of stimulation, and you can find yourself getting down, but always get out and do something, talk to people, go and do a talk somewhere, go and do something, start writing a book, whatever. But get out and meet people is a big thing, and a good little trick as well that I sometimes do myself is to, if you're losing a little bit of confidence, is remember the last. You know, the last time you did something great and it really, really worked. And remember it and visualize yourself back doing it and what you were wearing and if it was a talk you were doing or a meeting you did or a sale you won. You know, remember what you were wearing and what you looked like and what you said and the feeling driving away from it. Wow, you know, I'm good at this. You know, remember that feeling again and you get it back.
Yeah.
That can work as well, yeah.
Wow. So, Paul, you've been a chartered surveyor, an author, a motivational speaker. You have a helicopter pilot's license. Do you have any other talents that you want to tell me about? Because I've heard, I've heard that you also work in creative industry, in a way.
Well, I think it probably ties in with, now, I probably don't do so much of this now, but I did this crazy Bono impersonation for a couple of years, going back about 5 years, which got me on the TV on the Mario Rosenstock show and various funny bits and pieces. And I toured the world. I got to South Africa doing Bono, which is and I don't want to do it anymore. I stopped doing
it. So you won't do it for me now?
No.
How can people see you doing your Bono impression? Because I just found this out today and I have to see it. Then.
There might be bits and pieces online. I don't know. but it was a bit of fun for a while. And I did a bit of songwriting and I wrote some sketches and some comedy stuff and some RTE commissioned me to do a couple of kind of songs, businessy songs and semi-parody things, which, you know, were all aired and so on. So there's a definite kind of a zany creative streak in there somehow. But
how do you approach it when you go to do an impression of Bono? How do you research it?
It came, well, it just came, it's, some people would say I go to England, and I was in London recently. The taxi driver turned around. Is that Bono? He said, just your ad. Starting from scratch. Now, I don't sound like Bono to my mind, but to a London cabbie, you know, we do. Oh, no, he says, you're Bob Geldof. That's who you are.
Oh, they really thought it was.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, we didn't. But
you don't look at all like Bob Geldof.
No. But I always played the guitar and sang and mucked around in bands. And I Love You Too, which is going to get us somewhere near my last song.
Yeah.
And they're the soundtrack to my life, you would say. I Love You Too. Huge respect for them, love their music. And there was this, you know, in the band we used to play U2 songs, and I'd kind of find myself, you sing as you heard it and you sound more and more like it. And then it was actually a show that Savills were doing in London after they had bought our company, and they jokingly said, it's a big charity thing called Party Near the Park, and they said, we need someone to represent our company. And I said, okay, and they said, we need you to do Bono. And there was a huge band and backing singers and 8 weeks of rehearsals, flying to London most weeks. This is a big, like the X Factor or something. Oh, good fun. But I said, yeah, only if you put a stylist on it, because I don't have all the right stuff. So they went and bought the old Bulgari sunglasses for £450, bought me the right trousers. They made me a jacket and the military badges and all the stuff, shoes and everything. And the right, and so suddenly I had all the gear, so then I was kind of set up to do it. So that's really where that came from for a while, and it was a lot of fun for a while. But
have you had any feedback from the man himself?
No, I've met him a couple of times, just and I've never mentioned it or talked about it. But
getting tips for yourself for the yeah, for the next impression.
Yeah, but I'm huge fans of theirs. You know, it's just incredible. 35 years on the go, still writing new music, touring the world, packing it out with new music. Like, they're not just doing the old stuff. So, class act.
We're going to take another break now. And I will ask you once again to play a song of your choice. So what is the second song that you've chosen for us today?
Well, I think this time we're going to go with Hozier, which is, this is the most modern piece of music I'm choosing. I'm from Bray, and he's from those parts as well. My kids got to know him in school. He's the most low-key, down-to-earth guy. And I heard this voice on the radio 2 or 3 years ago, and I said, who is that? And what is that? This is new type of music. Is this a black guy from Detroit? You know, aged about 60? That voice. And the songs he's writing, and the powerful of the words, and he's a brilliant singer. This is our Andy, this is the local guy. And he's just, I'm so kind of proud of him. And I wrote a thriller, which we might talk about later, the Manhattan Project. And I, because I'm a big fan of music, I have a lot of musical scenes laced through it, and I use music as a backdrop, and I wrote him into it, just as in America, these people talking about this new guy Hozier. I got a bit of fun doing that. But he is the coolest guy and the nicest guy you could meet. And
that's so good to hear.
So, Hozier.
Hozier, and this is Nina Card Power.
Yeah.
Wow, an incredible song from an incredible artist. Here's Hozier.
Sunshine 106.8.
Hello there, and you're very welcome back to Sunshine Meets. It's me, Elaine Stenson, presenting tonight, and I'm joined in the studio this evening by businessman and motivational speaker Paul McNeeve. Paul, you have had the most incredible story, and it's been fascinating. How did you get into motivational speaking exactly?
Well, it came out really from finding myself speaking quite a bit at business-type functions. But I was always interested in I'd heard other motivational speakers and people telling their stories, and I found it quite powerful. And I suppose my own story had a lot of lessons in it, and people asked me to do one or two things, and it really just took off, I suppose. So, you know, you've got to work at it. You can't just get up and ramble on. You've got to prepare your, normally it's 40 minutes, 45 minutes, sometimes it's an hour. You've got to, you know, it's got to be a really strong hour, 40 minutes, whatever it is. So you practice. And then the more you do, the better you get, I suppose. And every single one I do, you know, you still feel nervous before. And they're all a little bit different. I mean, a lot of the story we heard and we talked about earlier on is a basis for a lot of it and what I learned in rehabilitation. But companies would often say to me, there's usually some particular thing, there's a theme to whatever conference they're having or whatever is going on in their business at the time. So they might ask me to particularly talk about customer service or sales or leadership or change, if there's a lot of change going on in an organization. So, you know, probably half of what you do each time is quite different. And that's challenging as well, because it's nice to work with different companies all the time. And they're kind of opening their hearts to you on what's going on in their company to some extent. And then you, I suppose, the tricky part then, and what I hope I'd be good at, is adapting my stuff and my experience and stories in a way that has an impact on all the people listening, that you emotionally connect with them, and that they remember you, not just for 2 days, but they remember your stories for weeks and weeks and years and years, in fact. And the trick to it, of course, is telling stories, because people remember stories. I mean, people will remember, your people listening now, you could have a quiz and ask them, you know, a lot of things about my life. They'll remember because, you asked me and I told you, but yep. They're stories. If you get up at a conference, and as most people do, or a lot of people, and put up facts and figures and PowerPoint, and, you know, an hour later, no one has a clue what they were on about. I mean, that is the worst possible communication ever. But they say the greatest storyteller of all time was Jesus, because people are still telling his stories. And how did he get his points across? By storytelling, the parables. And every story had a little moral to it. So the stories I tell about learning to be a helicopter pilot, what I learned from that was that I had a million times more potential than I ever realised. And we all do. We just don't realise it. So that's, you know, you use a story like that, bring it into the business environment, and I find that challenging and interesting.
What is the biggest challenge facing employees working for the companies that you work with?
Well, it's funny. I mean, now we're kind of boom time again to a large extent, particularly in Dublin. I'm looking out the window here, you can hardly see the sky with cranes. You know, it's just amazing. It's not quite so hot everywhere else, but
as individuals, yeah, you know, as employees.
Yeah, well, to me, and it's a pity, it's the kind of the 0 hour, the shift to contract working, people not being given proper contracts, you have no pension, all of that stuff. You're trying to save, where do you live? You know, people, the rent, paying rent. These are the huge problems for people trying to save for a house. And that has changed, and for the worse, I would say, because, you know, people of my generation and even, you know, people 20 years younger than me you were paying whatever you were paid, you could afford to pay your rent and save up and get a deposit on a house. And now, certainly in Dublin, that's more or less impossible. It's really difficult.
So for people who are kind of hopeless about those situations, how do you, as a motivational speaker, motivate them?
It's really tough, but I mean, what most people are doing is just doing their best, and you've got to put your head down. You make sure you keep working, you do your very best, you advance yourself as much as you can, so you're earning as much as you can. You perform brilliantly. Just don't go out and be average. Go out and be, and then you'll stand out. And, you know, then you won't be, you'll become the boss. You start your own business, you'll take over. You know, perform brilliantly every day. You know, go out and just be superb. And we do it. Dazzle.
And is this in your book? You've a book out. You've two books out.
Yeah.
Small Steps, Everything is Possible.
Yeah.
Tell me how this came about.
Well, Small Steps is a book I wrote, and it's not in the shops anymore, but you can get it on my website.
What's your website?
PaulMcNeave.com. And I'll sign it and post it to anyone. Maybe it might be a nice Christmas present for someone to give to someone who's facing a challenge or whatever. But it has done very well. It was a bestseller, and it's got a picture of me with my prosthetic legs on the front. And it was a book I wrote maybe 6-7 years ago when I'd finished work, and I just wanted to put all my stories together in one place. And it still sells very well. I mean, I might be talking to a big tech company or a bank, and they might buy hundreds for the staff, you know, so that's great. And then I have a thriller out at the moment.
I was just going to say, so how did that come about? Because this was obvious because you were a motivational speaker, so you have a book. But this, the Manhattan Project, and this is just, this is new.
This is new. This came out this year. It's been a bestseller in Ireland. It's out in the UK. It has been sold to a few countries in Europe. It's coming out in Germany next year, which is all very exciting. And it's a terrorist attack on New York. So that was, again, I just love those kind of books. And I always had this dream of, could I write a book, a story that would be good enough to become, you know, be published. And then not just in Ireland, also in the UK. And now it's spreading around the world. There's audio books out in Australia of it. You know, it's very exciting. And I'm writing the cover, the follow-up to it at the moment. But there's a connection in it, in that I won't give the story away, but a lot of people will have heard about antibiotic resistance. You know, the way that we're becoming, bacteria are becoming resistant to antibiotics. You know, the way the antibiotics don't work anymore. And this is a big problem in the world. And I use that in the book. Let's say the terrorists use it as a way to cause a lot of trouble. But I found out all about this through my own stuff, because little skin infections or things that I might have got over the years, I always took antibiotics, instantly cured it, until about 10 years ago. And now antibiotics don't work anymore for a lot of basic little infections. So this is where I found out about antibiotics. So I researched it and I kind of became fascinated with it, and it became the core of that story. So that's what's behind the Manhattan Project.
And how did you get that? It's very difficult to get a book published, isn't it?
Yeah, that was, now, to be honest, I really struggled for, because it wasn't, what I was doing wasn't good enough. I thought, oh, I'm good at English, I can spell. You know, writing a non-fiction story about your own life is very different from trying to write about people's emotions. As a character, as a sort of a 30-year-old woman in New York, and she's having romances and work, and I mean, how the hell do I know about that? So you're trying to get your head into that space, and then the doorbell rings and someone needs a lift and there's a leak in the roof and normal life, and you're distracted from it, and you go back to it and to try and get back into the space you were in when you were writing about. So writing fiction just took an awful lot of practice. You know, doing online courses, going to writing courses, went to Listowel, to the writing festival, learned a lot there, did a course for a week, and suddenly I got it. It's a bit like learning to ride a bike. You know, that sudden feeling of balance. Oh, this is it. And it was a bit like that, writing the thriller. I'd written so many drafts of it, and it was good, but it wasn't just, didn't have the magic sparkle. And then suddenly I got it, and I wrote it again. I said, yeah. And I was right, because I sent it out again, and within a week, I had two publishers competing for it, you know, after having all those rejections for ages. And now they're competing for it in, to translate it in around the world. So
it's incredible. You're extremely tenacious.
Yeah, probably am. I suppose I am. And to some extent, I had put so many hours into that, that just to abandon it was, you know, unconscionable. I just had to keep going. So,
and you also have an opinion column for the Irish Independent.
Yeah, every Thursday I write on property for the Irish Independent, and I enjoy that. And they came and asked me to do it, I'd say it's 5 years ago, and it was a kind of a little experiment. We'll try it for two or three, and here I am 5 years later. And I enjoy that because it keeps me in touch with a lot of my old contacts and buddies, and I go out, you know, you're all the time meeting new people, going into new companies. You know, we're here near Dublin Port. I was down with the head of Dublin Port recently, writing all about how the port works and the numbers of ships and the lorries. And it's just every week is a new thing, and I love that.
And obviously with your background and your column, what's your take on the property market at the moment? I mean, is there going to be another crash?
Please God, no. I don't think so. It's interesting. I mean, house prices are the big problem, but they haven't gone mad like before. Like, they're back up 82% since the bottom of the crash. But that's from a much lower base. Now, interestingly, like, house prices have nearly stopped increasing. the rate of increase now is quite small in Dublin. Around the country, it's stronger, but you know, it hasn't increased as much. And this time around, the central bank is stopping the banks lending too much money, and that's a good thing. The big problem is there aren't enough houses being built, and that's a shame and it's a disgrace, because you know, we used to build social housing, we used to build thousands, tens of thousands of council houses, and we stopped 20 years ago and thought the market would provide it, and it doesn't. And it's been too slow sorting that out. So it's coming right, but slowly. So I think it'll be okay. Commercially then, which I probably know most about, it's red hot in offices. We're looking out the window here, all these new office blocks being built, particularly in Dublin. Cork is red hot for offices. Hotels is hot. It's pretty good. Industrial property is very strong. So they're all signs of a really strong economy, which we have. So hopefully this time everyone will be more sensible.
Yes, and on that note, I'm going to ask you to pick your final song, because I do know it's going to be a U2 song.
Yeah, and my final song is One, which is a lot of people's favourite song, and it just is kind of special to me for loads of reasons, and I kind of link it to various things in my life, some of them great, some of them not so great, but it's a song that was always there and I always love it. So let's finish with One.
Okay, here's One, and just before we play it, I just want to say you can get your two books are available online, paulmcneeve.com. So we have The Manhattan Project, your work of fiction,
and that's in the shops too.
Oh, that's in the shops. Yeah, yeah. So we can get that at all good bookshops nationwide. Yeah. And Small Steps is on paulmcneeve.com. That's correct. Your motivational and how-to guide. Okay.
Yeah.
And on that note, we're going to leave it there tonight, folks. That's another edition of Sunshine Meets with me, Elaine Stenson. I was joined by Paul McNeeve. And here is U2's One.